We acknowledge the original owners of the land on which we podcast, whose stories were told for thousands of years. Today, we are recording in Meanjin. We pay our respects to elders past and present who may be listening. Sovereignty was never ceded. A quick note before we get started that there may be some swearing in today's podcast. If you don't like swearing or usually listen with children in the car, you have been warned. This episode of What in the NDIS Now is brought to you by Astolte. Astolte is the software solution for NDIS professionals built by NDIS professionals. Astolte is my go-to software, and Astolte is trusted and loved by hundreds of other NDIS providers. I love how easy it is to use and how it keeps all my participant information, notes, and invoicing all in one place, available to me anytime from any device. Sign up now for your 14-day free trial. Head to astolte.com.au to sign up now. See for yourself how much easier managing all your NDIS business needs are by using Astolte. Thanks again to Astolte for sponsoring today's episode. You're listening to What in the NDIS Now, a podcast where I, Hannah Redford, and my friend Sam Rosenbaum interview participants and providers about all things NDIS. Hey, it's been a while, but we are back. Life has well and truly gotten in the way for everyone involved with What in the NDIS Now. And we will have some exciting news to share soon. But we are hoping to return to our regularly scheduled bi-weekly release of podcast episodes now. We are starting with an episode that we recorded ages ago with the amazing Storm Hassett of the Identity Clinic. Storm is doing amazing things both within and outside the NDIS, and we highly recommend that you check the show notes for links to everything that she is involved in right now. For now, welcome back to What in the NDIS Now. Here is, at long last, our interview with Storm. Welcome to the episode today. Now, Sam was on the call and then he got pulled away by a client, so he's hoping to pop back in some point in this conversation, but he might not at the same time. Now, also the joys of living in suburbia, you might hear some drilling or jackhammering because the house across the road is being renovated. And this morning we've heard jackhammering that is unfortunately coming through on the recording. So I apologize in advance for that. But today we have a really awesome guest. We have Storm. Welcome to the podcast, Storm.
Thank you. Thanks, Hannah. Thanks so much for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
We are so excited to have you, and we have been wanting to have you for a while. So it's great that you're here. Now, as we always start the show, where did you grow up?
Yeah, where did I grow up? So fun. So I actually grew up on Dara Country in foster care, which was a fun time, and later stages in foster care with my grandparents. So that's out in the Hawkesbury of Western Sydney. So for people that might not know, Western Sydney is a part of obviously New South Wales, way out west. So it was a place of, I guess, you know, it was very, very beautiful and I guess a lot of deep complexity for me growing up in care, especially as a queer and Indigenous kid. You learn early that, you know, systems kind of just see you as a bit of a number. And I guess for me, living, you know, out west and in the Hawkesbury was always very beautiful, but there was a lot of complexity to it, to be honest.
Oh, I can only imagine. I was the flip side of that, my parents fostered kids. So we had foster kids coming through our house a lot when I was growing up. So it,
that's beautiful.
Yeah, I think seeing the system when you're young and when you're young knowing how broken it is, you know, is just horrifying. And I've heard some stories just recently of that it's still terrible, and it just boggled my mind that it can still be done so badly.
Yeah, 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 very much so. I think, you know, when we talk about trauma and the complexity of intersections, of disability and those kinds of things, like there's so much that comes with that. And I think that we're most definitely in a space where people aren't being provided with the right support and the right care, which further just leads to further cracks in the system, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So tell me, how did you get into the disability sector?
Yeah, so I guess the disability sector, quote unquote, get into. I, to be honest, I kind of belong to it. You know, I'm neurodivergent. I've lived with complex trauma, my background psychology. I know what it feels like to be dismissed, pathologized, misunderstood, and all of those kind of things that come with that. I've watched so many people, beautiful people, brilliant minds, be quite literally crushed by systems that weren't made for them. And the NDIS is certainly one of them. So I kind of just thought to myself that it's time to stop waiting for somebody else to fix it and support my community. So, yeah, I decided to jump in and, you know, we're not exclusive to the NDIS space. We work across private practice, NDIS. We support people on workers' compensation and CTP. But I decided to build a service that honours both lived experience and obviously, you know, care in that space, that centres affirming care, that being our whole mission, and to treat people finally like they actually matter, because to us they do.
Yeah. So tell me then, let's start with the name of your clinic and then let's go from there.
Yeah. So the Identity Clinic, where did I essentially come up with the name? It was a time in my life where I've always experienced quite a level of discomfort around my personal identity. But I actually opened the Identity Clinic and started the organization because of an experience that my best friend had had. And it wasn't a great experience. It was an experience that they didn't get the right supports. Being trans and neurodivergent, it's more often than not that the experience that you have is quite low. Like it's not great. And the word's not quite coming to mind, but it's pretty shit, to be honest. That's the word that is I'm going to use to explain it. The gaps that we see, the cracks in the system, people aren't just falling through them. They start in the cracks. And that's the really hard part about the community, being able to support the community. The Identity Clinic, a name is obviously born from identity, right? Inclusivity, care, and care that, you know, requires absolutely no judgment. It's a judgment-free zone. For us, we really wanted to focus on the queer community, and what better way to explain queerness and queer joy and community within the name Identity. And that's where the Identity Clinic essentially came from.
I do love the name, and I think it suits it really, really well. So tell us a little bit about some of the services that you provide there at the Identity Clinic.
Yeah, 100%. So I guess we have quite a few services, quite a few actually, and they span from, you know, your general mental health right through to assessments, gender-affirming care. So I guess our first service that we kind of established the clinic over was gender-affirming care, and really focusing on being able to support people that identify as part of the queer community, to better support them in their everyday life, provide them and equip them with the tools that they're required to be able to thrive So our gender and sexuality service is very specific. Most of the people we work with in that space, in terms of presentation, we're looking at things like gender dysphoria, body dysmorphia, often sometimes depending on the intersection, eating disorders. And then we have a general mental health service, which is a little bit more generalized. So it's just supporting people that fall under the umbrella of queer community, the rainbow umbrella. So anyone that falls under that umbrella is essentially eligible for our services. So it might be someone just struggling with, you know, symptoms of, you know, neurodivergence, or being able to focus at work, or they might be being bullied at school. And never to minimize, but I guess to give you a general understanding of what we do in the general mental health space, a general anxiety, depression, whatever you might be experiencing in life that has come up for you, we're happy to support you irrespective to whether it's got anything to do with you being trans, gender diverse or non-conforming. We also offer our incredible neuroaffirming assessments. So what we're talking about there is our autism ADHD assessments, which we're so happy to be able to provide. We've been providing them for just over a year now, and it's been amazing. We have never had an instance where a client's come back to us and said this hasn't been accepted by a specific scheme, not one single report, which is amazing. It's such a flex, and we love it because we write them in such a neuroaffirming way. Language is so important to the NDIS, and we really put an emphasis on how we write our reports. Our clinicians are absolutely phenomenal. My team is second to none. I love and adore them so much. They really are community-based. All of our clinicians are queer, neurodivergent, so you're quite literally getting lived experience. You're not walking into someone that has no idea what your experience is all about because they don't have the experience. Rather, our clinicians all have that experience. So yeah, that's a little bit about our services. We have some other, you know, niche kind of stuff that we do in terms of programs and groups and stuff like that, and always developing as well. Like, we always have more coming. We want to be ensuring that we're supporting our community to the best of our ability, and that's why we've always got new things kind of popping up and falling out and loving life.
I'm so glad that that your service exists. It's really, really exciting to me. And at the same time, sort of sad that it has to exist, because the mainstream should be able to support us, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And support our young people in particular who, you know, can find this really confronting. And then there's even like those older people who come to their transness much later in life, who kind of go, oh, my God. Goodness, I didn't have the words for it before, or I was a bit worried about doing it before. And then, you know, there's your team there to go, hey, we got you, boo. Let's go.
Yeah, 100%. And I think that's half the issue, right? That mainstream services and supports, you know, we often hear them say, you know, we treat everyone the same. And that's not kind of what you want to hear because, you know, in hindsight, again, if you've got, and I posted about it the other day, if you've got a broken leg, you know, are we going to expect you to be able to run the same marathon as everyone that doesn't have a broken leg? No, because they've got trauma to their body, much like a lot of queer folk. And I think the reality is a lot of the community outside supporting or, you know, attempting to support the queer community, it's kind of just a slap on the window of like, you know, here's a rainbow. We do it too, we guess. And it's not that great. I think for so long, mainstream kind of systems have expected us as a community to adapt to them, to kind of shrink ourselves and mask and perform, which is not what we should be doing. Instead, what we should be doing is you know, having those systems adapt to us. That's what's important. That's what's affirming. And that's what, you know, mainstream being inclusive is meant to mean. That's what it's supposed to be for. Yeah.
I love everything that you've just said, and at the same time, I hate when I say that constantly. If you ever listen to an episode of this podcast, it's me going, oh, I really love that. Oh, I love that. It makes me cringe every time I listen back to it and go, oh, can't I come up with something more insightful to say? But I just think everything you've said there is is great. And I absolutely agree. And there's so often I've spoken to providers or, and particularly in like the clinical space of like psychologists, and I go, so I just want to check, are you like trans friendly? And they go, like, that's not what we do all the time. And we're probably not the best people to do it because we don't really understand it. And I'm like, good, great. Don't go there then.
You
just stay in your straight cis spot and don't try and come over here.
Yeah. But I think, like, in saying that, like, that's half the problem, right? Mm. Because people really aren't trying to support the queer community. And I guess it kind of comes to mind when you say that, it's like, you know, they don't really support queer people. You know, they really don't support trans folk. They don't really know how to. And it's like, yeah, that's concerning, right? Like, you don't know how to support someone that needs support, irrespective of their gender identity or their sexuality or, you know, their presentation. Like, you don't know how to support them.
Yeah. And often my answer is, well, we're human and have a brain and, like, surely what you went to university for should be able to, like, slot in under human. But, it's tough.
Kind of, I don't know, like, I don't really see it. It's not really, a valid excuse anymore. It's like, 2025, babe, get with the program. We live in a time where resources exist, you know. People are so loud. Like, you know, advocates in the community are so loud. Trans people are literally out here building systems because they weren't built by anyone else.
Yeah.
Like, if you don't know how to support us, how about learn? Yeah. And that could be a thing, right? Like, pick up a book, understand, you know, start to educate yourself. Yeah, and I guess, you know, as well, like, so many people, and I think we see this all the time, people are like, oh, okay, but, like, what if I mess up? You're human. That's okay. You know, if you mess up, own it, do better. Don't apologize. Just keep moving and do better. That's all you can really do. And I think we hear it all the time, and it's like, we don't know how to support the trans community, or we don't know how to support the queer community. No, it's just not a priority to you. You don't want to do it. That's what you're really saying. And that's okay. But also, fuck you, because that's not good enough. Do you know what I mean? There are so many people, and we lose, in terms of the queer space, like trans, gender diverse, non-conforming, and the wider queer community, we lose people every single day because people don't know how to support. That is so ugly. Like, get with the program. You could do so much better. It's really not that deep. Put, you know, a little bit of effort into it, a little bit of, as my grandmother would say, put a little bit of elbow grease into it, and try your hardest to best support people, because that's all we're all here to do as humans. Love and compassion and empathy, all of those feelings that we can feel are so important to survival and supporting our community. That's what we do as humans. Why are we not doing it?
Yeah. That is so cool. Absolutely. Absolutely. And so awesome and sums it up so nicely.
Yeah.
So I want to ask you about where your clinics are located.
Yep. Yeah, of course, of course. So I guess depending on where you're located, but we have a few shared spaces. So we utilize, and more often than not, it's a very common model that you'll see in the space, particularly clinics that are predominantly online. So most of our clients, being queer and neurodivergent, often, you know, some people have a physical disability in combination with maybe an intellectual disability. In the NDI space, that's more often the trend that we see. And people like being supported from home. So a lot of people will jump on, they'll have telehealth sessions. In the instance that we have clients that need to be seen in person, we provide mobile services as well, and that's across the entire East Coast. So we have clinicians in Brisbane that can work across Brisbane CBD, all the way out to, I believe it's Ipswich. I'm so not familiar with the geographic area of Brisbane, but out to Ipswich, and we're recently looking at bringing a clinician on in the Gold Coast, which is really, really exciting. And I believe it's probably more familiar to you because that's the area in which you are in Brisbane or Queensland. So we have, we do utilize some clinical space and shared space that we kind of just hire per need in Brisbane. We don't have a specific clinic in Brisbane that we have, like it's our clinic. So we only utilize shared spaces. Now in Sydney, we have Newtown, Parramatta and Penrith. Parramatta and Penrith are our shared spaces. And then on top of that, we have Melbourne as well. So Carlton North. And then again, all of those spaces are accessible, super queer friendly and neurodivergent affirming. And on top of that, like I said, telehealth and mobile services is where a lot of our work is done, because going out into the community is really, really vital for us, and supporting people in their homes, in their community, at TAFE, school, wherever it might be, is something that we do a lot of.
That's really cool. It's so great that you go so far. And yes, going out to Ipswich is a good amount of like space.
Yeah.
And that you're in Melbourne and Sydney, but also I love that telehealth is a really good option, and it is for a lot of people. And then there are other people who are like, oh, I really can't get to know people when they're on my computer screen. And that's really hard. So it's great to have options. And it also means you can get out to like rural and regional without having to physically head out.
So, yeah, I think it's about accessibility, right? What do our clients need? And how do we best aid them and support them in a therapeutic environment? So we do our best to be flexible and support them in the best way possible.
And one of the things we do know is that being queer when you live rural and regional, it can be so much harder because small towns are not always the most accepting places.
Yeah, very, very true. And we see that more often than not, right? Once you kind of get out of the CBD in Sydney, for example, or Melbourne, you know, the supports radically decrease. And I, you know, same in Brisbane. I think in Brisbane there's significantly lesser supports than our bigger cities, Melbourne and Sydney. However, radically declines once you kind of step foot out of the CBD.
Absolutely. And it's, I think that's really important to understand about Brisbane in particular, because it is a more conservative city and we do have far less services than Sydney and Melbourne. And then it has recently gotten worse because, of course, the Queensland state government decided to ban gender-affirming healthcare for under 18s. So everyone has stepped up their little conservativeness because they think, oh, it's fine, I can do it because the government has declared open season on trans young people. And it's really awful here at the moment.
And it's similar to the US, right? I think, to be honest, it's low-key terrifying, actually high-key terrifying, that we are seeing, you know, in specific states like Queensland, which is, I would say, notoriously known for being a little bit more conservative. I mean, we've got our lovely friend, what's her name? The one that we all fucking hate, Pauline Hanson. She's from Queensland, right? I'm sure she is.
Yeah, Ipswich, in fact.
Right. I think Peter Dutton's from, isn't Peter Dutton?
Peter Dutton's in Queensland, yep.
Honestly, speaks volumes, right? Anyway, I think, you know, we know that this is an attack on transphobe. We know that this is basic, you know, human rights, autonomy and the ability to have a say over your own body is so vital. And again, we're seeing it attacked. It's not uncommon. We're seeing it all over the globe at the moment. And I think conservative leadership, particularly people like Peter Dutton, people like Pauline Hanson, people like Tim Nichols, right? That's his name. Yes. You're obviously going to see problems like this arise, and it's really, really sad. And a lot of the community is really scared because you see it in one state, you expect a bit of a ripple effect, right? And rightly so, it's concerning. We've seen what happens when fear, you know, continues and misinformation is the rhetoric. It's quite literally weaponized against trans folk, and it's so disgusting. It's so ugly. I hate it. But here's the thing, right? Our community is so strong, so strong. Look at what we have been through to date. For example, in the US, 52 protests across the country when things like the affirming care ban came out in an executive order. Look at her name's Jackie, I believe, running the Trans Justice Project across the country in Australia. Look at how many protests there were there. It's people are standing up. Like, we're not going to lay down and just fucking take it. Like, that's not going to happen. We're not going to wind back all the work that we've done all over all of these years. If anything, we get up with our pitchforks and we say, bring it the fuck on. Because, like, we've done this before and we'll do it again and we'll flatten you. And this is not a case of shoving in your face. This is not a case of, you know, we are trying to make you uncomfortable. Like, this is reality. This is human. Get real used to it. And this is the kind of movement that we need to continue to see change. And we, our generation, who we are change makers. And we won't stop until we see those changes and our people supported in the ways that they need to be.
Yeah, absolutely.
Sorry, it's probably powerful to just end like that. Crazy, crazy.
Thank you so much for saying that, because no. I think it is exactly, you know, exactly what a lot of people are feeling and struggle to come up with the words and to be able to sort of string them together. Now, I was able to speak at the Brisbane trans protest.
Okay, yes, 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 I did see that.
So, and we actually put my speech in our podcast feed.
Okay, yeah,
so
yeah.
So you can't even listen to it. And it was amazing because there were so many people there that I couldn't even see them all. Like, there were so many people that we couldn't see them, and that we had the problem of the PA that they had brought to the protest wasn't loud enough for the people at the back because they weren't expecting that many people.
Of course, yeah. How many people were at the Brizzy one? The one that you're at.
I don't remember.
But
it was a lot.
Yeah. And thank you, like, the hell, I think first and foremost, thank you for getting the fuck up and saying something. Like, that's incredible. You're incredible. Standing up and speaking the truth is not easy. So you genuinely should really commend yourself because our community sees it. It kind of, like, it gives me chills thinking about it, genuinely. The people that were there, like, I mean, we were down at the Sydney one in Newtown, just out the front of the new Pride Centre, and it was phenomenal. Like, the vibrations that you felt, the people that needed the support and were not going to sit down and just take it, it was incredible. And, I mean, the fact that the PA wasn't loud enough for all the people that was there, that's how you know that the movement is growing. That's how you know that something's happening. And these people are fucking outnumbered. They are outnumbered by us and our expectations. We will continue to see changes. We just need to keep showing up.
Yeah, and I have to show up because I have kids that are trans.
Yeah.
You know, young people who I gave birth to who are amazing humans and need me to yell at Tim Nichols and say, buddy, over my dead body. And, you know, they need it shoved in their face because they don't properly understand all the ramifications of what it is that they're talking about. Mm. And so we have to remind them of things like, well, cis children still get puberty blockers and you say they're safe and fine for them. So why are they not all of a sudden not safe and fine for trans kids?
Yeah.
Like either it's a safe medication or it's not.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah.
And that's the bit that kills me.
100%. It's gross and it's not okay and it's inhumane. And like, I mean, thank you for sharing that, particularly around, you know, your trans children. I was lucky enough to know that you had people in your family that were queer. I didn't know that your children were trans, but I thank you for sharing that with me. And I think, fuck, man, your kids are so lucky to have you. Like, do you know how many of us did not have, you know, parents standing beside us as kids, particularly trans folk? Like, a lot of us didn't have that. So they, you know, be so proud of yourself for showing up at these protests, for your children in their everyday life, and just supporting them every single morning when you get them out of bed. You're incredible. You're an incredible parent, and you should be so proud of yourself, the way that you're raising your children and loving your children. Again, we say this to people all the time, particularly parents. Babe, your only fucking job is to be a good parent. Just do that. You know, don't worry about their gender identity or their, you know, sexuality or getting caught up on, oh, did I cause this? Am I the concern? Did I do this? It, babe, you didn't do anything. You're just a parent. Just be a parent. It's your only job. And I'm so proud of you. Like, this is how we build a better world together. It's not through, it's not just through things like policy and you know, stuff like that. It's actually through showing up and sometimes leading the way and showing parents how to be parents for kids that, you know, don't always look the same as every other kid, right?
Yeah, well, I always think if you don't want a queer kid, don't have kids, because there is always a possibility that your child will be queer and in some sort of direction. And so if you don't want queer kids, don't have kids.
Yeah.
That's the option that you've got. You actually don't, there's no necessity to have kids. Yeah. I've had plenty. It's fine. You all don't need to keep going.
Yeah,
and whereas those parents that throw their kids out just because they're queer always upsets me, because I'm like, you're the one that chose to have them. Yeah. They didn't choose it.
Yeah.
Like you said, your one job is to love them no matter what. And you failed.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, no, I hear you. I mean, parenting, raising a child, it's not about shaping an individual into, you know, something you want them to be, right? It's not, you don't have choice in that. It's about holding space for who they are. And that's the reality. Like, we know, like, queer kids, trans kids, gender diverse kids, you know, they're not the problem. The system's the fucking problem. The shame, the silence that they're raised in, that they're expected to just conform to, that's the issue. If you're a parent and your love has conditions and it's based on being queer or being trans or being anything other than, you know, what you would outside in the world see as, like, quote unquote normal, how fucking boring. Don't call it parenting. You know, if your kid being queer, and we hear it all the time, people are like, oh, my kid turns out gay, if they turn out trans, like, they won't be my kid. Babe, you don't deserve to be a parent, point blank, period. Like, you just don't. You don't. If it threatens your values and you know, who you are, then maybe it's your values that need rethinking. Maybe it's you that needs rethinking, not your child. And they're really hard conversations that we have all the time. Yeah, it's wild, but quote unquote, and we're going to quote you on it, if you don't want queer kids, don't have kids. That's a whole, like, that's a whole vibe. Like, I love that. I'm so here for that.
Oh, I'm all about it, because it's in a similar vein of, you know, sometimes you hear people talk about how, oh, I would really hate to have a disabled child. Like, that's gross. In the same way, it's gross to say you wouldn't want to have a queer child. And, you know, my kids are, you know, talking about intersectionality, my kids are really lucky that they get to have disability, be queer and Indigenous.
Yeah.
And,
yeah.
you know, so those intersectionalities and also they're huge feminists.
Yeah.
yeah. And tell me what it means to you to be Indigenous.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, so I guess it was, for me, it was a little bit different, right? Being, I guess, growing up in foster care and with my grandparents, it's a complex and a life that probably not a lot of people understand. My grandparents are white, they're Irish, and I guess within that, you know, I wasn't raised around a lot of culture. I think for me, particularly growing up and coming into culture a lot more, yeah, it means carrying stories and understanding the community at a deeper level. Australia being a colonized place, you know, it's for me, being Indigenous means survival, means kin, it means culture, mostly spirit for me. Even, yeah, it's a bit of a tricky one, right? Because I think there's such a stigma around being Indigenous, and I don't know what the issue is, but there's so many people that have so many horrible things to say, and things I hear all the time is like, oh, well, you must get everything. Like, you get everything for free. Wrong. That's wrong. In my heart, I guess the connection to land and nature and the waters is so incredible to me. Like, for me, I've struggled a lot with mental health over I guess, my childhood and throughout my adolescence and into adulthood. And connection to land was a really, really big part about healing my soul. And, you know, our bodies are vessels. We carry our vessels and we just, you know, get on with it. But my soul needed a lot of healing. I experienced a lot of trauma as a child. And a lot of that healing was done, well, you know, in therapy, but a lot in nature, a lot of land, a lot of water. Some of my deepest, scariest nights were by the water. And it was spending time in reflection and understanding, I guess, who I am through the land, if that makes sense. And it probably doesn't to a lot of people. Sometimes it doesn't even make sense to me. And I think it's worth acknowledging that. But for being Indigenous is so much more than that. It's a responsibility as someone that is Indigenous and queer. I have to protect and honour my community. That's why we do what we do every single day at the Identity Clinic, you know, for our brother boys and sister girls. Like, it's so vital that our community is being supported. Being Indigenous, it's the pulse in my chest. It's why I'm here today. It's the blood that runs through my veins. Every fight I show up and I need to, it's why I continue to build these incredible organizations for my communities. It's why I never give up, because my existence for my communities continues to be the resistance for my community. And my pride is so much older than any of these systems, any of them. And we will continue to do what we do. We're so excited to continue the show. We've got some really incredible projects coming up in the next few months that I'm sure you will see, and you'll be like, oh my God, this is so exciting. But being Indigenous is a lot, and I'm so proud of it. And there's always so much to learn, and I will continue to learn. But yeah, I think I didn't get a lot of that education as a kid. Again, growing up in foster care, we actually didn't know we were Indigenous until quite some time into kind of like, I think I was like 10 when we were identified as Indigenous kids, and we were treated very differently because of the fact that we're Indigenous and now in foster care. So that provided us a lot of clarity, but it also gave us the ability to really connect with our people. One of my best friends, she's amazing. We grew up together. Their family kind of always knew it was very odd. Her mum used to say, oh, well, you know, where are those black fellas talking about us as kids? You know, and we only lived a street away from them. But she actually also had quite a lot of trauma in her life, and she has grown up to be an incredible solicitor, And I think with trauma and coming from these kinds of communities, what I mean by these kinds of communities is traumatic environments. When we're provided the right supports, the right care, the right love, the right recovery, the way out of trauma, the power that you see wielded by people that for so long were powerless is insanity. And I'm so excited to continue to tell those stories for my people in my community.
My daughter is 15 and she had to do a little documentary.
Yeah.
And so she came up with a set of questions and she was asking her sibling and Ellie, because it's Ellie's side of the family that is Indigenous. I'm very white from, you know, Western European ancestry. But, you know, I grew up with parents who were very interested in and wanted to give me a lot of that history. And that was really important to my parents growing up. So I know a lot of it because of my parents. But anyway, back to my daughter. And one of the questions she was asking was, do you think that at school you get enough education about Indigenous history? And
How old is she?
15.
Okay, yeah, yeah. Yeah, so that would be year, what, like 7?
Year 10. As part of that, I don't think there possibly is enough education in our schools because we've still got people so ignorant of the history. And so that's my personal opinion. So, yeah, let me hear from you.
Yeah. Interesting, right? So let me put this to you, right?
Yeah.
How many American presidents can you name?
Oh, fuck. I don't know. A handful, I guess.
Yeah. And how many Indigenous leaders can you name? Probably lesser, right?
Right. Sure. Yes, absolutely. So
that kind of speaks volumes that as a country, we know more about a neighbouring leadership than we do our own. And, you know, Indigenous folk are the oldest living culture in the world. We should know more. So I guess, do I think that there's enough education about the Indigenous community and First Nations people? No. Fuck no. I think that we, like, barely even have tipped the top of the iceberg. I think that most people, like I said, in this country can name more presidents from the US, you know, and I would definitely fall guilty to this. Like, I probably can name 10. And then when you think about like Indigenous leaders, our elders, people within the community, it's like most people wouldn't know those answers. And that's really, really sad because this is our country. We know more about colonizers than we do about custodians of the land. That doesn't really make sense. So I think education systems have kind of taught us generationally to see our history as a little bit of fraud, like it's not really real. Not as people who are still literally here today, still living, still breathing, still thriving. And I mean, it's a very, very small population in the country because the whole idea was to breed our community out, like our Indigenous community out. So yes, 100%. There's not enough education. I think we definitely need to kind of ingrain that in our education systems. True education means educating on the truth, educating on, you know, about Invasion Day, about survival and resistance, and about brilliance of our incredible fucking community. Like that's education. It means going beyond things like NAIDOC Week and token acknowledgements. Like we have to go far beyond that. Education is so vital for our community and the Australian population, definitely.
On that, I think I could name more English kings and queens. I was taught a lot of that too. So, yeah, I mean, that's seriously interesting. And it's like I love the idea that we're now, you know, naming places on the the First Nations names. You know, like we talk a lot about living in Meanjin here. And I love it. I think it's so great that we get to do that now.
Yeah, yeah, 100%. Yeah, no, I think it is so, so important. And I mean, there are so many nations, like within Australia, so many nations. I don't actually know the number, but there's a lot. And I think, you know, there's a lot of words to get around and understand, but I think that's an important part of our history. And I think without teaching that, we're not really teaching the truth. And I think that should be something that is in every classroom and part of all curriculum within the education system, because these are conversations that need to happen. I don't know. I kind of think, like, what are we teaching kids? That colonization was a chapter and it wasn't a crime. It was, you know, that we're, I don't know, like, it's sad, because this is a culture that should be remembered big time. And I think that at the moment we're just kind of like, oh, we pay our respects, elders past and present. It's like, do we, you know, how much do you know about the Indigenous community? How much do you know about the First Nations leaders? What do you know? It's like, if you ask that question, most people will say, yeah, Queen Elizabeth. And it's like, the fuck did you just say?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Awesome. So I want to ask you a little bit about, you've sort of talked about some programs that are coming up for you. Do you think we can give a sneak preview of some of those exciting programs?
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so we've got a few. So with the Identity Clinic or external to the Identity Clinic?
With the Identity Clinic.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, like whatever you want to talk about, I don't care.
Yeah. So the Identity Clinic is amazing and exclusively services the queer community, aside from assessments. But I guess for the Identity Clinic, some of the things we've got coming up that we're working on at the moment is we're working on a and an upward trajectory for our new project. It's called Project Meal, which is focused on providing a pop-up every month that will be able to provide essentially food for people that are sleeping rough. They're experiencing kind of homelessness and not being, you know, not accessing the right supports. And we're looking at partnering with a few different organizations to make that happen, which is really exciting. We've got some social programs that are in the works at the moment. I think one of the biggest things for me as a young queer kiddo, particularly in the space of foster care system, we didn't get taught a lot of life skills. So a lot of things that we missed out on were just things that, you know, normally mum or dad will teach you, you know, cooking toast, pasta, you know, 2-minute noodles, how not to burn yourself, how to wash your clothes. So we're looking at how to create a program for people that have been significantly impacted by their identity or sexuality. And what I mean by that is impacted in the way of kicked out of home, you know, lost access to those life skills or being able to better support themselves through learning with their families. So essentially we want to kind of act as a bit of a parent in terms of the Identity Clinic and provide those educational skills and those lifestyle skills to people that would otherwise not have them. And that will be likely through some classes, whether it's a cooking class for queer and neurodivergent folk in the inner west of Sydney. We will be looking at, you know, having some clinicians there and working as kind of like a peer project to better support them and see better outcomes, building community, having networking connections available for people to be able to meet new friends, people just like them. We're also looking at some group programs, so some therapeutic group programs that can kind of, you know, more often than not, you kind of see it in like a DBT space, skills programs, things like that. So we're looking at what might work for us long term to be able to support the community. I've got another project coming up and it's separate to the Identity Clinic. And what I will say is that this next step for us, this next journey, and it's going to be a very big launch, so it's not something that I'll go too in-depth into, but we are creating a hub focused on people with psychosocial, physical, intellectual disabilities, psychological trauma, injuries, that kind of thing. Justice system, the foster care system, out-of-home care, residential care, focusing on creating an allied health hub specifically tailored towards specialized care to be able to see those kids, just like me, that should have grown up to be prime minister, president, solicitor, doctor, whoever they were meant to be. They were tormented and not provided the support they needed. And they weren't able to come into who they were because of the trauma they suffered at the hands of somebody else. Our new company will be focusing on providing that elevated support in complex care to people who were built for greater, but not given the resources, support, recovery programs, and rehabilitation to be the person they were set out to be. So we have a really big focus on that over the next kind of few months, and I'm sure you'll see lots about that. We're very excited. We were very, very lucky to have support from some really, really big companies that supported us in funding, investment, and things like that. So we're very, very excited. But you will be blown away by what we have coming. We're so excited. We're trying to create a network of organizations that don't leave anyone behind anymore. Everyone comes as who they are, met with who they are, and what they could be.
I am so excited for this. We're going to have to get you back on when you can properly announce it and get you to talk about it some more, because that sounds amazing. Because even things like, you know, talking about being able to do wash your clothes, one of those tricks is being able to read the clothing label and know, oh, it can only be on this setting or that setting, you know, and that sort of thing is a higher level of executive functioning.
Of course.
Yeah. And that every washing machine has slightly different cycles on it. And so when you're in front of a new washing machine, still being able to feel confident in that you know what to do, because I think that's one of the things that sometimes gets people when they're taught on one machine and then they can't transfer that bit of information. So to start winding up, because it has come to that time, I'm going to ask you our final question. In your ideal world, what would the future of the NDIS look like?
Future of the NDIS. I think we should say goodbye to having to prove just how unwell you are. I think the NDIS should be there, built, designed purely to not try and prove dishonest, but try and support. I think it should be about recognizing people's strengths, their stories, and the right to access the support without jumping through hoops. I think we should walk away from looking at disabilities as deficits. And I think, you know, one of the hardest things for me is we talk about a scheme that's supposed to be helping people, but it's most beneficial to talk about people in a deficit way. That's not helpful to people trying to build capacity. We wouldn't have this exhausting culture of compliance and gatekeeping with the NDIS. We shouldn't have it. And rather instead, we should be having people that are trusted to provide care. I think Black voices, queer voices, disabled voices, these people are so vital in building a structure and a system that works for NDIS. And I think they should be really taking that feedback on. I think taking more advisory from people that are living with disabilities, I think that's where we can begin. I think most of all, the NDIS is building right now, I guess, what we should be building is a lifeline for people. That's what we should be focusing on. And we need to start being kind of like a vehicle for opportunity, for housing, education, employment. Like, oh my God, employment. There is some incredible. I actually volunteered yesterday with one of my good friends from Able Minds. His name's Pagnoni, and they have an incredible program, supported independent, supported employment. And I was talking to the barista, and he's learning at the moment. He's so great. He's like, oh my God, I earn so much money. And this is someone living with a disability. He's like, I earn so much money. And I was like, really? He's like, yeah, I got paid yesterday, $700 or something. And he's like, can I get paid tomorrow? I'm so happy. And I was like, are you saving? He's like, yeah, like, you know, I want to save for a Mercedes. And I was like, that's what I'm fucking talking about, right? Like, these people given the opportunity to be able to live life. That is true identity. Right. And this is what the NDIS should be providing people, the ability that wouldn't otherwise have the ability to be supported in these environments. We need to stop asking these stupid questions of like, how do we manage this disability? You know, and start asking, how the fuck do we invest in this? How do we invest in these people? How do we look for a brighter future for our people? That's what we should be doing. Fuck all this deficit shit. I'm so over it. Let's start pushing towards great outcomes, but a system that rewards and incentivizes and is desirable for people to do better and see greater outcomes. Yeah, because right now people are not being supported the way they need to be. They're having funding cut left, right, and center for, you know, like we had a client that didn't utilize all their psychology funding. So it got cut. How does that make sense? Oh, you didn't use it, so it means you don't need it. Or it means there's not enough services available, or it means that they haven't found the right supports. Do you know what I mean? Like we look at everything from like a deficit standpoint in the NDIS space, and we need to reframe that. Yeah. I think that's where we will go really well, really hard and really great for our greater community.
Fuck yes.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Yeah.
It's been so amazing to have you.
Yeah.
And we'll definitely have to get you back on at another time.
Yeah, yeah. I hear it, and I'm so thankful for you having me. And if I can kind of leave you with anything, it's like we're not here to play games. You know, we're here to make change and support the people.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Until next time. Bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening. Please share with people you know. Until next time, as the Green Brothers say, don't forget to be awesome.